In association with Newsarama.com, welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sutras. Spider-Man 3 is less than a month away, and we check in with the creator of Venom, David Michelinie. David tells us what it was like to enter the business and create such memorable characters as Venom, Carnage, Jim Rhodes, and Claw the Unconquered at DC. We cover his Spider-Man and Superman years and talk about his legendary runs on Iron Man with Bob Layton, including the seminal story Demon in a Bottle. This episode of Word Balloon is sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And don't forget to visit InStock Trades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at dcbservice.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. When you think of David Michelinie, the Avengers or Spider-Man or Iron Man may spring to mind. But believe it or not, Michelinie's career began across the street at DC Comics. We pick up the story with David.
I was working for a commercial film production company in Jeffersonville, Indiana. I had just gone freelance and was living across the river in Louisville, Kentucky, writing commercial and television and movie and educational scripts. I had sent some samples into D.C. D.C. had a something called an apprenticeship program at the time. That's why I sent my samples to. And for some reason, they went to Joe Orlando's office, and they ended up on his slush pile. And Michael Fleischer was his assistant editor at the time and had some time. And one day after lunch, read some of my stuff, sent me a letter saying, you show potential, but we can't work with anyone outside of the New York area. If you're ever in this area, drop by. So 2 weeks later, I had closed out all of my freelance accounts and moved to New York and showed up on his doorstep. Yeah, I took a big chance. I had like $600 in savings. My mom gave me $500, so I had $1,100. Living in New York, never been there before, with no promise of work. It was exciting.
Your first jobs were House of Secrets stories?
Yeah, I worked for what they called mystery books at that time, because horror was a word that was frowned upon by the Comics Code Authority. So House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Weird Mystery Stories, Weird Mystery Tales, you know, Weird Mystery, Weird War Tales. Like that, anything from 6 to 10 page stories. That's how I learned. It was actually a good learning ground because I had to learn how to write self-contained stories within a very small amount of space.
Were Michael and Joe very instrumental in terms of getting you to adapt to the comic book format?
Michael was helpfully ruthless. He actually edited my first two or three stories before he left to write the Little Orphan Annie newspaper strip. And he pulled no punches. If my stuff was crap, he said, "This is crap." And it worked. It was good. I wasn't mollycoddled. Michael was very honest, and it made me really want to learn so he wouldn't call my stuff crap. And so I did. And by the time he left, I was at a point where I was at least writing professional stories and could work directly with Joe Orlando. Joe was amazing as a teacher. He wouldn't tell you, "Oh, this isn't bad." He would say, "Well, sure, this is really what you want." And I said, "Oh, yes, definitely. That's exactly what I want." And I go home and I think about it and say, "Oh, that's bad." So I come in the next day and, "Why don't we do it this way?" He said, "Oh, what a great idea." I make it look like it was all my doing. But he was a great teacher. I learned a whole lot from Joe.
Was Unknown Soldier your first regular series?
That was. And Star-Spangled War Stories.
It was one of my favorites, and I was really glad to rediscover it in the recent Showcase collection. And I remembered the work of guys like Joe Kubert and Robert Kaniger and stuff, but I enjoyed your stories as well at the end. And a departure for the character, because originally it was a bandaged character that was wearing these kind of rubber Mission Impossible sort of masks, and things changed under your run. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I found it difficult to buy that a rubber mask could fit over bandages and still look like a real person talking and so forth. So we decided to take a chance and get rid of the bandages, just show the damaged face, and show him actually putting makeup on, creating masks and stuff like that that would fit his face and would be believable.
It kind of made for more of a horror book.
Well, I was, this is what, 1972 or 3 or something like this, and I got out of college in 71, so I was in college during the anti-Vietnam era, and I was pretty pretty strongly anti-war and a great believer in the best way to show the horrors of war is to show reality. You don't have to preach it, you just have to show it. And the fact that this guy's face was ruined and he became a grotesquerie because of a hand grenade was part of war. And I thought, okay, I don't have to be preachy. I don't have to get up on a soapbox. I just show what can happen. And I like that aspect of it.
The mystery line, as you call it, I always love that line. That was all under Joe Orlando, is that correct?
I know Joe did Claw. He did Kong, which was a kind of a caveman character. Starfire? Yeah, Starfire, which I originated.
What was that character like?
Well, I was asked to come up with a female sword and sorcery type character after I was doing Claw the Unconquered, and I really didn't want to do just, you know, a female Conan or a female Elric. I decided that it would be more interesting to make it Sword and Science, have a kind of a fantasy world where there were, you know, almost an Edgar Rice Burroughs kind of Sword and Science, where there's high tech but people still ride around on horse-like beasts and use swords and knives and so forth. And that's where that started. I just did the first two issues before I had to give up something because of my scheduling.
Did Marv Wolfman use any of that as a template for the Teen Titans Starfire?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he just came up with the same name, which happens all the time.
Well, let's talk about Claw. I was, on the one hand, glad to see him back, but in a lot of ways, like when they brought back Warlord too, I don't understand why DC didn't go back to the guys that made them good in the first place. You know, in the case of Warlord, it was Mike Grell, and in your case, Claw.
Yeah, it was the first series that I created in comics, and it was like, at that point, the pinnacle of my dream. I had set out three goals for myself. One, I wanted to sell a comic book story, get it published. Two, I wanted to make a living at it. And three, I wanted to create a character and get it in its own series. So it was very special and important to me. As far as, you know, not going back to the original people, heck, the youngsters who are doing the book now, I mean, the editors probably don't even know I'm still alive, you know, let alone that I still write. So, you know, they go with what they want. They you know, they go with the people they know. That's okay. That happens.
A neat character, and starting with a Conan sort of template, but certainly much more horror and fantasy, and then, of course, the Claw itself.
Well, yeah, I was asked to do a Conan-type character, because Conan was very popular and selling well for Marvel at the time, but I didn't want to do Conan. I mean, you know, there was already a Conan, so I tried. I was a big fan of the Michael Moorcock, Elric, and Corum series. Basically, Elric, Corum, and Cormac MacArthur and all of these different characters from various books were all aspects of the same universal warrior, I think that was the term. And I liked that very much. I liked the whole Zord Stormbringer that was almost sentient and could control him and generate this bloodlust in him. And it was more of a fantasy setting than hardcore sword and sandals. And that's what I wanted to move the book towards, and Joe Orlando was very supportive in that, and that's what we tried to do.
Again, great series, and I think that whole line had a lot of interesting original ideas that got shut down because of the DC implosion, am I correct?
Well, first off, thanks, but yeah, I always liked, when I was growing up, I was always a big fan of the off-the-wall characters. You know? I read some Superman, not much Batman, but, you know, I like Keith Carson, Adventures in Spider Earth. Sea Devil, Rip Hunter, Time Master. So that kind of stuff, including, you know, like the Shadow and so forth, are not your mainstream superheroes. I always found them more interesting for some reason. So writing them was a lot of fun.
What happened to make you go to Marvel instead of staying at DC?
Well, there were many things. The straw that broke the camel's back was had to do with the artist on Star Hunters, which was the second series that I created for DC. And we had a lot of problems keeping an artist on it, and we were redesigning the spaceships the main characters were flying around in, and the artist submitted a handful of designs, four or five that were pretty amateurish and crude, and one that was very good. It was a Xerox. The others were originals. This was a Xerox. It had these strange holes at the top of the Xerox, or Xerox holes, whatever. And we went with that design, and, you know, after the first issue was, like, in print of that, with that design, I turned on TV one Saturday morning, and there was a cartoon show whose name I forget, But there was our spaceship. And it turns out the guy had submitted a Xerox of an animation cell as his design. And line for line, our spaceship was the Saturday morning cartoon.
Wow.
So I was heavily invested in this series. It was my creation. And I felt it was like, you know, this was insulting and it was embarrassing. And I said, you know, I can't work with this guy. You know, he's a thief. You know, he stole his design as his own. Turns out the other five designs were his assistant. He didn't even do any of them. That's why they look kind of amateurish. So I was told by DC, oh, okay, well, we'll get a new artist. You're right. It's a matter of ethics and morality and all this stuff. And we'll do what's right. And but just don't say anything now. Let him finish this issue, because if you tell him he's fired now, he might leave. We'll have to get someone to fill in and finish the book. So I said, okay, and I kept my mouth shut. The book was finished. And I said, okay, who's our new artist? And they said, no, we're keeping the old guy, knowing that I would leave. And I did. I called Jim Shooter, and I asked him, can I get some work at Marvel? He said, would today be too soon? And he sent me, I think it was 17 pages of Avengers artwork to dialogue.
So, wow.
Yeah, that was kind of like night and day. DC at that time really didn't have a lot of respect for writers. They were very much an artist-oriented company. And Shooter was much more interested in writer and story, as well as the art at Marvel. And it was like coming home to a home I had never had.
That's wild. Yeah, before we leave DC, I'm curious about that, because I just spoke to Marty Pascal, and you always do hear stories that a writer would submit a script, and how heavy were the editor's hands on certain books?
Well, I worked mostly with Joe Orlando, and he let me have a lot of freedom. I felt very fortunate. Like I said, he was a gentle teacher. He would suggest and point out, and then let you kind of figure out that, yeah, that's bad, I'll do it better. He rarely edited my copy, and there was actually an artist who complained about that, because I didn't get along with the artist. But Joe told him, well, the reason I don't change his copy is because I like it. It gives me what I'm looking for and what I want. So
that's good.
So I appreciated that. But one little tale about how DC really revered their artists over their writers at the time. I was writing Aquaman and for a while, and there was this one story where Aquaman was fighting some character underwater, and there was this boat that was on the edge of a crevasse, and it was kind of, it could go either way, fall over or fall back, and there was the bad guy, there was something on the boat that the bad guy wanted, and I called for him, this was all done full script, called for him having this sonic gun that he was using to eat away the sand and rock in front of the ship so it would tilt back over onto solid land. And he gets in a fight with Aquaman. The ship tilts over and falls into the crevasse. And then later on, the bad guy gets the sonic cannon and tries to use it against Aquaman. Well, the artist was drawing page by page. He hadn't read the whole story. So when he put the sonic cannon on, he put it attached to one of the railings on the ship, which is puzzling, so how can you shoot it under the ship if it's on the railing? That was all off-panel. So then when the ship fell over into the crevasse, the cannon was on the ship, so it fell into the crevasse. So he came to the page where the bad guy's supposed to use the sonic cannon against Aquaman. It's at the bottom of the crevasse. So he just threw it floating up from the crevasse, sitting itself down on the edge again. No explanation. Suddenly, what am I going to do? And my editor told me, well, we don't want to insult the artist. So I had to rewrite, without pay, that entire page to try to make some sense of why this cannon was floating back up from the crevasse. I think I had him, Aquaman, think he had this octopus, pet octopus, I think named Topo. And said, oh, couldn't save the ship, but good thing Topo was able to save the sonic cannon. You know, which is like, you know, why would you want to? But anyway, that's so they wouldn't insult the artist who had not bothered to read the script. So anyway, that's the end of my tales of the early days of DC. I did have a very good time, and I was treated very, very well. I don't want to give the wrong impression, especially with Joe Orlando's office. There were just some very, very weird incidents that make for interesting conversation.
Well, what was the transition like going from full script at DC to the Marvel style of plot first and then getting finished art back and dialoguing the finished layouts?
It was a time of great insecurity because when you write full script, you control everything. I mean, admittedly, the artist doesn't always give you what you call for, but you control the pacing of the story and, to an extent, the visual. So it was a learning experience, and through that, I've become a big believer in the Marvel style as far as the end product, because the Marvel style, once you've seen the pictures, if the artist has missed the point or is not clear, you can use your words to clarify what's going on. And I think that makes for a better end product, more readable end product. But yeah, it was quite an adjustment to make at the time.
On the Avengers, it looks like you were one of several writers on a story arc, and maybe getting direction from Shooter. Am I correct that one of the first stories you worked on was the Korvac saga? Is that right?
That was totally plotted by Jim. Yeah, he asked me if I would script several stories in that because of his schedule. He was just so overworked. And I said, sure, of course, yeah. So that was, you know, why his name was on that. He bought him. It was his idea. Now, there was one where, I think Roger Stern came in and did an issue or two when I was writing an Avengers paperback novel. I had to take a couple of issues off. The Knights of Wondegore kind of arc, something like that.
Okay.
And I think Mark Gruenwald did some of the plotting, and Roger Stern had something to do with it. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look at the issues.
I thought Steve Grant was mentioned in a couple of your stories as well.
Okay. I had to give up. I think it was three issues, and I was off writing Iron Man during the day and writing this Avengers novel at night, so I didn't really pay that much attention because I couldn't. I had too much stuff. So then I came back on and took over, but... Those are two instances why there are other people involved. And if there are others, you know, feel free to ask. I don't remember right now.
Well, that's wild, though, because an article that I read where you were being interviewed by Joe Casey, that going into the Avengers, you hadn't read the Avengers, and that you really kind of came in cold.
Exactly. Well, when I rediscovered comics in college and got to be a big Marvel fan, Spider-Man was the only real mainline book. I read The Off the Wall. I read Conan. I read Silver Surfer. I read Submariner. You know, but I didn't read The Avengers or Iron Man or Fantastic Four or X-Men. I kept reading the Off the Wall characters except for Spider-Man. So, yeah, I had never read an Avengers before. Well, needless to say, Jim sent me a lot of reference. So,
okay.
I did my reference and worked from there.
Tell me about the novel. There were great spurts of, like, very interesting Marvel novels through the 60s, 70s, and on, obviously.
Well, this was a series that was edited by Len Wein and Marv Wolfman. And I think there were 10 of them, and mine was the 10th. And they gave me, like, 5 weeks to write it. I'd never written a novel before. So it was called The Man Who Stole Tomorrow. And it was a fun experience. I was living, like, 50 miles away from... Three Mile Island during the time, and that was the time when it was melting down. So I was, writing Iron Man in the morning, writing an Avengers novel in the evenings, and waiting to hear the sirens go off to evacuate.
Wow.
It was an exciting time. Many people know about it because I went looking for it myself. None of the bookstores in the local town where I was living had them, and so they looked it up in their book order book. There was this list of Marvel novels, and it went down one column and ended at the 9th. The 10th, which was mine, was up at the top of the next column. So most bookstores, when they were ordering them, just went through and ordered that column, didn't know there was a 10th one.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, so a lot of people didn't carry it, and that's why a lot of people don't know about it, although considering the overall quality, that's probably good.
Was living so close to Three Mile Island informing scripting for Iron Man back then?
No, because I'd never paid any attention to it until it started to melt down.
So. Okay. You're best known, I think, for your work on Spider-Man, which we're going to get to, and Iron Man, and especially your work with Bob Layton. Demon in a Bottle, certainly one of the classic arcs. This was pre-Watchmen, and I think there was a level of storytelling going on in Iron Man that was a little more adult.
Oh, well, thanks. We didn't really make any efforts to try to be adults or anything. I think we were just plotting and me writing stories that we thought were interesting and taking a look at the character and saying, okay, if this was a real guy in this situation, what would he be like? What would he do? What would be done to him? Which is kind of the approach I've tried to handle most superhero characters, because you've got such a basic basically ludicrous situation where someone with all these powers and running around in colorful suits and everything is to ground it in reality. You've always got to think about the human being who's in there and how they're going to handle all these problems and stuff. And especially with Tony Stark, I mean, he doesn't have any powers. His power is his brain. You know, he makes who he is. He makes his hero. Spider. Mm-hmm. Peter Parker got bitten by a radioactive spider. The Fantastic Four went through radiation. Tony Stark created his hero. And he's probably the most normal and human character at Marvel. Well, it was at the time, at least. And that's such a fascinating concept. It was like an endless treasure trove of story ideas. You take a real person. So that's what we did.
Was Iron Man your first collaboration?
No, we did. Bob was actually assigned as the inker on the last couple of issues of Claw the Unconquered at DC.
Oh, okay.
And so that's how we met, and we became friends. And then when we both left for Marvel about the same time, I think I left first, and then Bob followed a few weeks later. And when Iron Man came along, the chance to do Iron Man, I'm not sure if Bob suggested me or if just, you know, because I was friends with Jim Shooter at the time, if, you know, and Bob was a friend of Jim's, and we were all together. I don't really remember, but it was a good pairing for any number of reasons. One being that Bob was a huge Iron Man fan, so everything about Iron Man he cited out, and I'd never read an Iron Man comic before in my life, so I could bring freshness to it, a new viewpoint from the one angle, and from Bob's angle, we have this grown-up fanboy who knew everything about the character. So it was a good combination. It was a good set.
What went into the thinking of let's make Tony Stark an alcoholic?
I have to say the initial idea was mine. Again, coming at it with a fresh perspective on the character. At the time when we took over the book, he was the guy, I forget the specifics, but like he had just had some kind of attempted takeover by S.H.I.E.L.D. or some such, or I think his girlfriend had left him, and he had all of these problems. And again, looking at it as a real human being, with all these pressures, business pressures, personal pressures, is either going to explode or is going to seek an escape. And it just seemed natural at the time that, you know, a playboy, millionaire playboy, that was the established character. Well, playboys drink. You know, they party, they drink. That was part of the established character, and it just seemed like a natural progression for him to go a little farther, to where he became dependent on it, to release the pressures of his day-to-day business life and risking his life as Iron Man. So that was pretty much the origin of that.
Were the editors at Marvel cool about the story? They didn't see it as a problem being too adult theme for a young teen book?
No. Jim Shooter, who was the head guy at the time, his entire qualification of what we could do, a qualifier, was do it well, do a good story, and didn't put any limitations on it at all, just said do a good story, and so we got a great deal of freedom there, and it was very, very gratifying to have such confidence shown in us, and we did our best to make it a memorable and entertaining storyline.
You guys also came up with Jim Rhodes, who was a very important character, now is another hero in War Machine, but your take was that it was an important supporting citizen that Tony can lean on. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, Tony needed friends. That was one of the reasons he got into alcoholism. He kept everything inside. He didn't share. He needed a friend, and we created characters in that book as we went along as they were needed. That's how Mrs. Arbogast became... He needed a secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Arbogast happened. He needed a head of security, so Vic Martinelli happened. He needed a pilot, someone he's not going to fly around as Iron Man. He's not going to, even though he can fly a plane or could. You know, how many executives do that on a regular basis? He needed a pilot. And, you know, he also needed a friend. And here we've got Rhodey, who was a tough guy in his own, a smart guy, tough guy, combat experience. Basically, on an equal level as Tony Stark, the human, on many, many, many areas. So and they became friends, and it was something that Tony really needed. And that was really his purpose under our reign as the creators on the book.
I'm looking forward to, I heard the news that you and Bob are coming back to Iron Man and doing, I'm glad Marvel is doing this. Certainly the story truly never ends, and that's kind of the point of comic books, but they're allowing for these certain series that if there was a final ending, there's going to be one for Iron Man, the end, and it's you and Bob doing it?
Yeah. Yeah, papers haven't been signed, but agreements have been made, so yeah, it looks like we're going to do a 48-page one-shot. Based on a pitch that we turned in about 5 years ago, that there were some disagreements as far as some of the elements of the story. So we decided not to do it then, but apparently things have smoothed out. We're going to give it another shot.
I think that's really ambitious, maybe in more secure hands because you're the kind of guy that can deliver a one-shot, but almost unheard of in these days of six-issue story arcs and four-issue story arcs that you know a story can be told. So I think I'm looking forward to it. You've told me in a previous conversation that the second time around, Bob was more involved as a writer and was kind of feeling a little more secure as a writer. Is that a fair assessment? Did I get that right from what you told me?
Our second run on Iron Man.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, yes, Bob had become a writer between our first run and our second run. Our first run, he was an inker, and you know, we co-plotted, and it worked out very well. And the second time, Bob was had become a writer. He had more, I guess during the first run, he would acquiesce to me for the most part because I was the writer. I was the person putting the plot together and writing the script. The second time, he had a stronger feeling about the story and the writing and so forth because he had his own experience as a writer. So that's one of the reasons, one of many, why the second run was different from the first. Not necessarily better or worse, but different. We were both, you know, hey, we were years older, had years more experience than for both of us.
Hope the papers get signed and hope it happens soon.
Well, they're talking about putting it out like in conjunction with the movie. So
sure.
2008, so that's probably when that will come out. So.
Okay.
Let's hope we all enjoy it.
Yeah, really. Any involvement on your own with the Iron Man movie?
No, none. They've not asked me.
Okay.
I did get an indirect invitation to do some DVD special features for the DVD, of the eventual DVD of the movie. Bob Leighton did some of that. Through him, he asked me if I would be interested, and I declined. So, but that's it. My participation will probably be limited to spending $10 to see the movie.
Let's hope Favreau gets it right.
Oh, man. I do hope.
Yeah. What do you think of the comic book movies so far, of this current batch? And I'll put the starting point with Blade, because to me that really seemed to be the first one of this new generation of films.
I really liked the second one a lot.
Okay.
The first one was okay. It has a very interesting opening of that, the club.
It was.
Yeah, it was. The rest of it was just. It was okay, I thought. And then the second one I liked quite a bit. And I never really read a lot of the comics, so I can't say how close it was. But I liked. It worked really well, I thought. The second, third one was a little lighter tone, but I found it entertaining.
And the Spider-Man films and the X-Men films. What do you think of those?
Well, Spider-Man, I just delighted me to no end. I mean, my God, they did it right. What are the chances? I love the first one. A lot of people like the second one better. I didn't. I like the first one better, but I like the second one a lot. My main problem was that like 14 different people know he's Peter Parker after the second one.
The whole subway car knows that he's Peter Parker after the second one.
Well, they know he's the guy. They know his face. They don't know his name. I don't think they got his wallet out. But yeah, I didn't like that. But I really liked both of those movies a lot. The X-Men movies I found very enjoyable, entertaining. Again, I never was an X-Men reader. But I liked the first one a lot and enjoyed the second and third ones both.
And I guess Fantastic Four, and how about the DC movies, Superman and Batman?
Oh, Batman Beyond was fabulous.
Yep.
I absolutely loved
that. Or Batman Begins, I guess.
What did I say?
Batman Beyond.
I'm sorry, Batman Begins. You're right, right, right. That one was fabulous. Batman Beyond was the animated one, which was interesting, too. Superman Return was I thought was okay. I was impressed with Brendan Routh. I hadn't expected to like him, and I did. Wasn't that thrill with Kate Bosworth? She was Lois Lane.
Yeah, she seemed horribly miscast.
Yeah, she didn't seem to have the fire
that
Lois Lane should have. And Kevin Spacey was okay as Luther. I don't think they've gotten anyone. I mean, as much as I like Gene Hackman, I don't think they've gotten a really solid Luther yet. Maybe a white Michael Clark Duncan.
Sure. He was a good kingpin. You know, we didn't mention the Daredevil movie. What did you think of the Daredevil movie?
I thought it was okay. I mean, I didn't hate it. I was entertained. I didn't buy it on DVD, but it was okay.
Fantastic Four?
I really liked Jessica Alba in her underwear. My favorite part of the movie. Other than that, again, I found it entertaining. Nothing I'm going to run out and buy, but I was entertained while I was watching it.
Well, let's talk about Spider-Man, because you had such a long association with him and a very meaningful one. Some big landmark things happened during your run. One of the first ones, and it was early in your run, am I correct? The marriage of Peter and MJ.
Yeah, that was one of the first things that happened. One of the things that was set up before I took over, and I kind of threw a twist onto things, because I read the book for years and years and years, and always wanted to write it, and then I get to write it, and it's not the same character. He's married.
Sure.
So, but it was interesting. It was an interesting challenge, and I actually enjoyed writing that aspect of it very much.
You work with two landmark artists in Todd McFarlane and Eric Larson. You and McFarlane created Venom. And tell me about the creation of Venom. What led to that?
Okay, I was writing Web of Spider-Man while Tom DeFalco was writing Amazing. And Peter David was writing Spectacular. And I had come up with an idea for a character. The alien symbiote costume had been ostensibly done away with in earlier issues. And I was looking, I always try to think of the unique aspects of whatever character I'm writing, and one of the unique aspects of Peter Parker is his spider sense. I mean, no other character, at least at the time, had anything like it. It's someone punches him and he reacts instantly, because this is instant warning. And I thought, he's gotten so used to that. It doesn't even think about it, and got so dependent on it. What if there was a character who didn't trigger the spider sense? How would that affect him? So I had set up something where in one issue of Web, I believe it was a hand comes out of the crowd on a subway platform, pushes him in front of a train, and he escapes. He doesn't get hurt, but he's shaken because the spider sense didn't tingle. Another story, I had a hand, he was on a clinging on a wall, a hand comes out and grabs his leg and throws him off the wall. And again, his spider sense didn't tingle. And I was setting up this character who had melded with the symbiote costume. And at the time, it was to be a female character. And her background was a woman who was pregnant, was about to give birth. Her husband was trying to get her to the hospital. He ran out into the street to flag down a cab. But the cab was watching Spider-Man fight someone, I think the Living Monolith or something. I had it tied in with another story. And the cab hit the husband and killed him. And the shock of seeing her husband killed in front of her caused the woman to miscarry right there on the street, and this kind of snapped her brain. She lost her child and her husband, and all because Cabbie was watching Spider-Man. So she developed this psychopathic hatred of Spider-Man, just through the symbiote who hated Spider-Man for rejecting him. Yet, together, and they were to become this villain. Well, then I would switch from Web to Amazing, and didn't have a chance to follow that up. Then Jim Salicrup, the editor of Amazing at the time, wanted something special for issue 300, which was coming up. They wanted a double issue, and he suggested creating a villain, so I mentioned this character I'd started developing in Web, and he liked it, but he thought that maybe the readers wouldn't be able to buy a female character standing toe-to-toe with Spider-Man, and send your letters to Jim Salicrup. It wasn't me. So I said, okay, and so I came up with a different background, with the whole Eddie Brock background, tied it in with the Sin Eater storyline that Peter David had done. That became Venom and Amazing 300.
What do you think of Topher Grace being cast as Venom?
I'm not that familiar with him. I know he was on that 70s show, but I never watched that 70s show. And just what pictures I've seen, and actually seeing one of the 12-inch action figures of Venom. He doesn't seem to have the bodybuilder body that the comic book character did.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they're taking out. It's not a big deal, I guess. But I don't know. I really can't judge. I don't know that much about him. I hope they'll do a really good job. I have to tell you, though, when they announced Thomas Hayden Church, as having a role. I was hoping he was Venom.
Sure.
But he'd be great. And the clips that I've seen of him as Sandman look fabulous. So, well, Raimi's done everything else, pretty much everything else right. So I'll wait until I see the movie.
Will you are you participating in that film in any way?
Oh, God, no.
Wow.
Nobody contacted me whatsoever, so...
Gee, that's kind of sad that the creator of Venom isn't going to be involved in a film where Venom clearly is going to be a big part of the film.
Well, I don't know how big it is. I mean, I've heard that it's just kind of a cameo or a small part at the end. But, you know, it's okay.
Okay.
You know?
Well, maybe that's four. Maybe that'll be movie four.
We'll see. I mean, that'd be cool. I mean, I read some things about the possibility of Raimi coming back for four, and I think someone said something about maybe someone will back up a truck full of money to Tobey Maguire for him to come back. And, you know, that'd be fabulous. I'd love that. I mean, it's going to be a kick one way or the other, seeing this. I mean, it was a kick writing Spider-Man. That was great. Creating a character and then having people, you know, like the character, having a life after its creation, and then seeing it on a major movie, it's just... I don't think it's ego. I think it's maybe comic book fans still in me thinking, wow, that's really cool.
How about Carnage?
Yeah.
You wouldn't think that, given Venom's immediate success, that a darker Venom would be necessary, but yet you know, lightning strikes twice, and you did it again with Carnage.
I like that. Dark Venom. Kind of a, you know, what is that, a contradiction in terms? Overkill, no pun intended. Yeah, well, I just, again, Jim Salicrup was very good in allowing me to only do Venom stories when I had an idea for something new. He didn't force me to do Venom stories. He kept other people from doing Venom stories. So it gave me time to think about the character and the aspects of the character. And one of the more interesting traits is Venom's, to me, and is Venom's really twisted sense of morality. He feels that he is the victim, that Spider-Man ruined his life, took his career away, and that because of this, feels he should protect other, quote-unquote, innocents. So he considers himself a good guy. And he'll plow his way through a busload of nuns and orphans, killing them all to save a kitten, because this poor kitten is an innocent. It won't hurt him because he's crazy. but that the idea of someone having this incredible power and not having that even sinister of moral senses appeal to me. I always like showing how a character is unique because it's a person. You know, Peter Parker, you or I could get bitten by a radioactive spider. We would not become Spider-Man. let's face it, who would? Peter Parker did because he's Peter Parker. Someone else got the Venom symbiote. They wouldn't become Venom. They'd become someone else because Eddie Brock is the core of Venom. So that's why I created this Cletus Cassidy character, had him get similar, if not identical, powers, but he's an unrepentant sociopath. He doesn't even have this made-up moral sense. And that's why Carnage came up. I wanted to show that contrast to point out how unique a character Venom is. But nobody expected it to take off. I mean, the first three-part story was done solely because we all thought it would be a cool character, a nice story. First two issues sold out. Nobody expected it. They had to go to a second printing. So, and this is back in the days when there were like hundreds of thousands printed, not, you know, 20 copy run just, you know, second printing or something.
Sure.
So, yeah, nobody expected it. And that's doubly satisfying in that we didn't try to do an event or sell comics. We just came up with a good story and people responded to it. It was great.
Tell me about Wedding Superman, because that was an interesting time.
Huh.
Was that when things were coming, you know, the same storyline was being followed every week? Was that part of your run?
I was one-fifth of a writer.
Yeah.
There were four monthlies and a quarterly. And I got onto that right after I left Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man. And I was supposed to be exclusive to Valiant, but once I left Spider-Man, apparently I wasn't as appealing and they stopped taking my phone calls. I never got that contract, so Mike Carlin called me and offered me Action Comics and saved my life, for which I won't be ever grateful. I did 3 years on Action Comics. We get together once a year for a Superman conference, I guess they called it. Get all the writers and the artists in, and we talk over, and the editors, and we talk over what we do for the next year. And then we use that as a template for the stories that would run through all five titles for that next year.
Was it tough? Was it easy sharing the load? Or was it, you know, hard to take, you know, a Barbara Kiesel script and have to, you know, continue the thread in your own style for a following issue?
Actually, it was Carl Kiesel.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
Now, actually, I did.
Oh, Louise. Louise Simonson, right? Because I knew there was a woman writing. Okay.
Louise Simonson, Roger Stern, Dan Juergen.
These are good writers. I mean, that's the thing. These are all heavy hitters that were writing it. And, you know, and you had Mike Carlin editing. He's a heavy hitter as well.
Oh, yeah. No, they put good people on that book, those books. They wanted them to kind of be, you know, kind of, well, flagship, of course.
Sure.
Of the company. So I was very flattered and very happy to do that. It was tough because I'm, despite reputations to the contrary, I'm not a real aggressive guy. I don't have a huge ego. I knew I was coming into all these other people who had been on the books sometimes for years, some of them for years. I didn't want to go in and say, okay, well, this is how I think Superman should be done. So I was rather passive and as such, kind of went along with other people's storyline and didn't get to do a lot of maybe what I would want to do. And I frequently was like, ended up doing like the second part of a three-part continuity, so I treaded water a lot and kind of start at one point, do what I could, and it kind of ended at another point. And I'm sure the other writers had the same, set of challenges as I did. They were more used to them, perhaps. But so yeah, it had its good and its bad. I had three editors in 3 years, and I think three artists, three pencilers in 3 years. So there's not a lot of continuity going there. So it was not an easy assignment, but it was an interesting one, and one for which I was very grateful to have had the experience.
In a lot of ways, what DC is doing now with 52 mirrors what was going on with the Superman books.
Okay,
it seems.
I've heard the term. I have absolutely no knowledge of that continuity. I've never read any of them.
Okay, no problem. Moonstone Books. You're working on a Kolchak series for the Night Stalker.
I've written a 3-issue miniseries called The Frankenstein Agenda, penciled and inked by Don Hudson, covers by Bob Layton. Yeah, those 3 issues and. Hopefully people will find it entertaining. I loved the old TV series, and it was really quite a kick to write a new Kolchak story.
Are you doing some prose work for Moonstone as well?
I have a prose short story in a paperback anthology called The Phantom Chronicles, which is supposed to be published in May.
Okay.
A Ghost Without Yesterday, and it will be one of, I think, 15 or 16 short stories in that collection. Looking forward to seeing that.
Were you a fan of the Lee Falk character?
No. I was familiar with it. I really liked the Billy Zane movie, and
yeah,
I liked that. That was a lot of fun. But I had not read a lot of the newspaper strips and such. Moonstone was kind enough to send me a collection of those and a couple of the collections of the comics, and that, along with about 4 websites and the Billy Zane movie, were my reference for that short story.
I always give the Phantom his due.
Well, it was funny in doing my research, something I didn't know, because it always struck me as kind of weird, this guy running around the jungle in a purple outfit. You know? I actually poke a little fun of that in my story. But originally, he was supposed to be brown. And the guy, I guess it was Falk, who created the original comic strip, he was supposed to be a brown costume, which fits in with
sure.
the jungle. And for some reason, it was colored purple, and it went print that way, so they stuck with it. So I guess you have to chalk up some of the goofiness to that itinerant colorist.
And I guess King Features is very specific that it has to stay purple, because I know of Moonstone artists that have wanted, on occasion it's been pink, and let's stay away from that one, but on other occasions it's been a gray costume. Oh. And I always thought the gray look was very cool, and it certainly kind of lent itself to the Ghost Who Walks as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't noticed those.
But, I guess King Features is like, nope, it's purple, and it will stay purple. We're King Features. It's like, all right.
I can imagine people putting, you know, turning Superman's costume in green and red instead.
Well, red and blue.
Wait a minute. Superman. Oh, okay.
How does that, looking back, I mean, the blue Superman hung around for a while, and that was kind of interesting.
I don't know. That was, I left right at that point, I believe.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot to do. That, or if I did, I forgot.
There you go. Hey, and before we wrap up, I wanted to ask, because I had Walter Simonson on, and we talked about Star Wars, and your guys' run specifically on it, which I always felt was an interesting run, because it was right after Empire, before, you know, a year or so before Jedi, and you guys were at a very tough point in terms of what stories you could tell and what stories you couldn't because of, you know, you go ahead and explain.
Oh, well, we were, again, we were treading water in a number of ways. We for one, one of the main three good guys, Han Solo, was busy being frozen in carbonite, so we couldn't use Han Solo in the series. I was able to do a flashback and an annual that featured him, but we were basically without him. We couldn't develop, of course, the relationship between Luke and Leia because nobody knew they were brother and sister. A lot of things we couldn't do. So we kind of treaded water, but it was an awfully fun pool to tread water in. You know? I had a great time. I hope Walt did too, but I was really happy with those stories. And it was like when you're a kid and you see a movie and you go home and run around in your backyard and pretend you're the characters, make up new stories. And here, I see these great movies. Now I get paid to make up new stories. It was really a wonderful experience. I liked it a lot.
He told me that one of your creations was you had a big kind of ship that, you know, certainly wasn't the Death Star, but it was some big ship called the Tarkin, and it was named after the Peter Cushing character.
Right, right. Yeah, that in the original plot, that was the second Death Star. That was one of, like, I think two places where they actually said, no, you can't do this, because they were doing a new Death Star in the third movie, which we didn't know. So we made it into basically a ship with the same cannon instead of the round planetoid. And got away with it that way.
And also, I guess, the other big problem that you guys weren't allowed to deal with was Luke and Darth weren't allowed to face each other?
Yeah, because that was a big part of the third movie, too, the final confrontation. We got away with that at one point using a hologram, and it ended with the story of the full-page splash of Darth Vader coming out, Luke, I've come for you, or something. Surprise, next issue, it's a hologram. A little cheat, but it was dramatic.
Well, what else have you got coming up, David?
Well, the only absolutes, the two Moonstone projects, the Kolchak miniseries and the Phantom short story, the probable Iron Man The End. And I'm working on a pitch for a noir graphic novel for Vertigo, which has gone through any number of revisions. I'm hoping to get some final word, hoping that'll get a green light.
That'd be great.
But not absolute. And I'm working on the very early stages of another project from Moonstone featuring some of their licensed pulp era characters. But that, again, is very, very early there.
Well, cool.
That's it.
Well, we look forward to them, and I appreciate your time today. And, you know, I absolutely stress that or suggest people go out and check out the trades. There's a lot of collected works out there with your name on it and plenty to be had, not just Spider-Man and the Avengers and Iron Man, other works as well. So check them out.
So far, I have never autographed a copy of Mother Teresa of Calcutta. But it's out there. It's out there.
A nice companion piece to Steve Grant's Life of Pope John Paul.
Well, I thought it was a nice companion piece to my Orkin Pest Control Spider-Man story. There's a lot of Michelinie out there, but you've got to hunt for it.
Well, check it out. Thanks, David. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure talking with writer David Michelinie. Don't forget to check some of David's trades, including Spider-Man, The Venom Saga, Iron Man, Demon in a Bottle with Bob Layton, and the recently released DC Showcase featuring the Unknown Soldier. This episode of Word Balloon is sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And don't forget to visit InStock Trade's sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at dcbservice.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, if you want to contact us at Word Balloon, you can reach me at john@wordballoon.com. And if you enjoy the program, make sure you subscribe to the Word Balloon RSS feed. You can do that at iTunes, also the various podcatcher sites like Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, Odeo, you name it, we're there. And we'll be back next week with a new episode of Word Balloon. We begin a two-part conversation with Greg Rucka about a lot of interesting projects he's got coming up. Until then, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007.